Part 4 of 6 from set number 3001, Alchemy Past and Present. A BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Alchemy and the Eucharist, from Aquinas to Hume.
And this evening we have not probably very frequently discussed topic of alchemy and the Eucharist. Now, it is undoubtedly no news to you by now, after our earlier discussions and also probably in light of some of your reading and so forth, that the alchemical activities, the flourishing, in fact, of the alchemical discipline, as far as we are able to determine, coincided to a major extent with the flourishing of the Christian religion in the Middle Ages, and particularly around and subsequent to the time of the Renaissance. While obviously there was alchemy prior to that time, as its name declares, as we said before, at least Western alchemy in all likelihood originated in Egypt. Certainly there did not seem to be a great deal of incompatibility between the practice of the Christian Church, even in its somewhat forceful and dogmatic medieval form, on the one hand, and alchemy on the other. And if we look into quite a large number of the alchemical books, the alchemical codices that are in the various museums and libraries, then we find that alchemy was indeed a highly religiously flavored practice, that the alchemists apparently all professed at least to being very much devoted to religious Christian principles, and that, for instance, the preparation that the alchemist was to undergo prior to engaging in the great work were always of a religious character, a great deal of prayer and religious exercises being involved. It is also well known that numerous prominent churchmen in the same period were alchemists and had themselves written alchemical treatises. Not only have they done that, but also were actively engaged in the alchemical work. This is a somewhat strange circumstance, or at least it is a circumstance that might raise some eyebrows, especially when one did not understand certain important connections. You may recall that, and I will come back to that probably later on, that some of the latest research into alchemy certainly indicates that at least from a certain time on, probably from about the 3rd and the 4th century onward, certain alternative forms of Christianity, particularly Gnosticism, a discipline with which I am quite familiar, have taken up alchemy, and that indeed the Gnostic Christian tradition to a major extent seems to have been funneled into, if I can use that term since I'm sure the alchemists used a lot of funneled into, transformed into alchemy in that period. And it was especially the man of whom again we shall speak today at some length, C.G. Jung, who set modern scholarship on the track of this intimate connection between Gnostic Christianity and alchemy in his discovery that the 3rd century Gnostic teacher Zosimos of Panopolis seems to have been one of the key figures around whom this change of Gnosticism into alchemy took place. Now, the Gnostic variant of Christianity was the first and in many ways perhaps the most abominated of all heresies, and is still so regarded by various people. Even the otherwise really rather nice gentleman, at least I regard him as such, Pope John Paul II, in his book, had referred to Gnostics in rather uncomplimentary terms, while he spoke in much more complimentary terms about Muslims and others. So, let's say the dislike of the mainstream church for the Gnostics still exists. Yet, here is a discipline, alchemy, which, according to many indications, was a symbolically disguised variety of Gnosticism, practiced and taken up and championed by numerous people within the Catholic Church to a considerable extent. We even have a rather interesting work, which I understand has recently been republished. I still have one of the earlier volumes. In fact, I think every time one of these rare volumes is republished again, the monetary value of my library plummets some, because this was really my book was really very valuable a while ago. I doubt that it is now. However, I'm glad that the book has been republished, which is an alchemical treatise entitled in Latin Aurora Consurgens, which means the rising sunrise, the converging sunrise, and the morning sun, the dawn, the rising dawn, which is attributed to one of the most famous and still greatly revered figures of Western Christian theology, Saint Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, I believe sort of 13th century, if I'm not mistaken, was a Dominican monk who in turn, as a young man, was apprenticed to another churchman who was originally a monastic but then became an archbishop in Germany, Albertus Magnus. And Albertus Magnus, even more so than St. Thomas Aquinas, had the reputation of a magician and an alchemist. And it was from Albertus Magnus that St. Thomas is said to have learned his particular alchemy, his alchemical knowledge. Aurora Consurgens, which merits a little bit of consideration, I often give lectures about it. It's quite a complex work in 7 chapters, is a work of Christian alchemy. It describes the alchemical transformation process in 7 stages, which certainly has been done, and utilizes a large number of quotations from sacred scripture, primarily from the wisdom literature of the New Testament, you know, such books as the Book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Ecclesiasticus and the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon and some of the Psalms, most if not all of which in their infinite unwisdom the Protestant reformers had excised from the Bible, so you are not going to find it in the King James Version and places like that. But in any event, there are a lot of quotations from these biblical sources in St. Thomas's Aurora, wherein a whole interesting alchemical mythos is put forth, which declares that what the alchemist is trying to do is liberate wisdom, Sophia in Greek, or Sapientia in Latin. The mysterious personage who is described in the wisdom literature of the Bible from her material confinement. And so in the 7 stages of transformation, as described in the Aurora, in each one some obstacle is being removed from the manifestation of Our Lady Wisdom, Our Lady Sophia. Yet it is quite evident from the book that what Thomas is writing about is alchemy. About half of the quotations in each chapter are from the Bible, and the other half are from the writings of certain alchemists. And so here we have, and it's certainly not the only one, a specifically Christian medieval religious approach to alchemy, wherein a certain kind of a cosmic task is being approached. That cosmic task being the liberation of wisdom from material confinement. And so when you go through the Aurora, you see first that there are various, these various barriers are removed. There is the flowing of the waters, which is the alchemical submersion into the water, and then there is rising to the sky, and then there is the fire, and there are the powers of the seven planets which are being addressed and purified, and so forth. So it's a very good example of the convergence, let's say, in that particular historical period of alchemy and the Christian religion. The Aurora Consurgence, incidentally, has been translated by C.G. Jung's noted disciple Marie-Louise von Franz, and it is in her translation with her psychological commentaries that it is available. If you are interested in it, you can probably find it at the bookstores of some of the Jung institutes here or in other cities. So this is really an established fact that there was constant convergence, let's say, between Christian interest and alchemical interest, and that the two were not considered to be antithetical throughout history. It wasn't really the Christian religion that put an end to the interest in and the dedication to alchemy of a lot of people in Western culture. Now, I'm not trying to exonerate the Inquisition or anything of that sort. Those boys had done plenty of damage in other areas. But one of the areas which they did not touch really was alchemy. It was the coming of rationalism subsequent to the Renaissance, and even more importantly subsequent to the Protestant Reformation, the gradual rise of rationalism, and then arising from that of an entirely new, totally physical and unspiritual approach to the physical sciences that had really caused alchemy to become disreputable in the eyes of the public, so that it was not rehabilitated to any degree and extent really until the 20th century, when it came to be studied and understood largely as the result of the pioneering work of Carl Gustav Jung in psychological terms. And so when we are now about to contemplate the convergence of the central Christian sacramental mystery, that of the Holy Eucharist, with alchemy, we also need to refer to a major extent to these pioneering insights and researches of C.G. Jung. Now, of course, the question may rise, well, after all, Jung was a psychologist. What does that have to do with anything? And various answers could be given to that, but certainly my answer is that Jung was much more than a psychologist. Jung was not, to use a colloquial term, a mere shrink or head shrinker of a modern persuasion or variety, but rather really a spiritual and philosophical figure of major proportions, certainly of the 20th century, who utilized the discipline of depth psychology as an entry point into the mysteries of the spirit. You need to keep in mind that with all its faults, our present era, let's say for the last 30 years or so, has been much more open, at least in many circles of society, to what people nowadays are often pleased to call spirituality, and which is really just, let's say, religiosity, renamed and rebaptized to suit the tastes of a secular society, you know. I am as well aware as anyone, and maybe more aware than some, of the great sins of religion in the history of the world, because my history has always been one of my great loves. To the present time, whenever I feel a little bit anxious or nervous or annoyed, I just read history, and it quiets me down. If I can't sleep, then I read the Los Angeles Times, and it puts me to sleep. But that's another story. So I'm giving you a little advice here about, you know, non-pharmaceutical ways of dealing with your various complaints. So, you know, religion is a two-edged sword, and indeed some of these edges have cut many people very badly over the ages and still do in many places. Certainly one needs not to look terribly far, such as, say, to the Middle East and to Iran and to a lot of places, to see really nasty things that are done by religion today. But just because that shadow of religion has always been present does not mean that there is not a fundamental validity to the religious effort. The term religion, coming from the Latin religio, meaning to join together or to join back, and meaning primarily to join the human consciousness with something greater, that is generally called divine consciousness, is, I think, a laudable, and not only laudable, but really all-important endeavor of the human mind. And as Alan Watts, who certainly was as open-minded a gentleman as any as I have known, pointed out once, there has not been a healthy and reasonably sane society in the known history of humankind that was not dominated by religion. Where does that put our civilization, our culture? I think it puts it probably in a category of not being terribly healthy and terribly sane. But then again, some of the folk that are around and who call themselves religious, I certainly wouldn't want to be dominated by, and neither do I think would you. So the problem goes on. But let's say in our past 20th century, one of the entry points into that mystery, which generally in the history of humankind was always addressed by religion, by churches, by religious institutions, by priests and saints and bishops and gurus and lamas and so forth, one of these entry points that at least for a period of time seemed to act as a quasi-religion was depth psychology. People who would not avail themselves of religion, certainly especially throughout the 20th century, did go to depth psychology. And that is where C.G. Jung was, and he was, of course, the most religiously, the most spiritually minded of the depth psychologists. Let me read you a little quotation from Jung that addresses that. He wrote, "I understood that within the soul from its primordial beginnings there has been a desire for light and an irrepressible urge to rise out of the primal darkness. The longing for light is the longing for consciousness." This statement, along with so many others by C.G. Jung, has both psychological and religious dimensions. And so we need to be aware once again of the fact that Jung was trying to evaluate issues that traditionally have been considered religious to a certain extent in a psychological light, but that this did not mean that he wished to reduce transcendentally infused or spiritual realities to mere personalistic psychology. That was certainly not his approach. But at the same time, he was not about to make concessions to conventional and dogmatic religiosity. numerous religious people, including Protestant ministers and Catholic priests, came to Jung and joined his movement because they felt that they might somehow psychologically rehabilitate their religious point of view. Most of them remained disappointed. And that is certainly also true, I think, when it comes to the point of convergence between alchemy and the Christian sacraments, and particularly the Christian Eucharist, as Jung treated it. Yet, from, I think, a dispassionate and at the same time perhaps deep point of view, when one looks at what Jung said about the Catholic sacraments, for instance, or about the more particularly the Catholic Eucharist or the Christian Eucharist, we will find that he approached it from a point of view which may not be identical with that of religious dogma, but which in its own way is just as religious, just as spiritual, if not more so, at least in my estimation, than the position of many people of a professed religious standing. Jung thought very highly of the psycho-spiritual value of the practices of the Roman Catholic Church. He didn't know as much about the Eastern Orthodox Church. He was not living in a country where that form of religiosity was very much present. But he certainly liked the Byzantine churches in Italy, like in Ravenna and elsewhere, where he actually had a real mystical experience. Not too many books write about that, but it's true. Because he felt that at least, and you need to remember that what we are talking about now is a period, say, from the 1920s until about 1960, but not very much beyond that, because he died. Not too many people write books after they die. And in those instances where such claims are made, the claims are usually not easily substantiated. Channeling and related flapdoodles. So, you know, within that period, Jung felt that the Roman Catholic Church was a very complete religion, that it still possessed a mystery, or even mysteries, and that therefore it was psychologically, psycho-spiritually far more effective than, let us say, the Protestant forms of religiosity into which he himself was in fact born. After all, he was the son of a Protestant, active Protestant minister in Switzerland. So Jung was not a Catholic. He never even, and this is rather difficult to understand, he never even entered in his entire life the city of Rome, which was really but a short journey from his residence in Switzerland. And I rather feel sorry for anyone who has never been to Rome, because it's really a magnificent place. But he had some sort of a great reluctance to do so. He started out a couple of times and always something happened. One time he fainted on the railroad station when he was about to board the train to go to Rome. And he took that as a sign that perhaps there was something inside of him that didn't want to go there, and so he gave up. Now, in any event, Jung had a profound interest in, let's say, an aspect, an element within the content of Roman Catholic religiosity, which he felt was psychologically or psycho-spiritually tremendously valuable. I also need to throw in what is called in Latin a caveat at this point, and I might come back to that again if I have time, namely that it is to be doubted that Jung would be equally enthusiastic about the practice, let's say, of the Roman Catholic Church at the present time, because it was soon after Jung's demise that tremendous changes occurred within the Roman Catholic Church, very few of which I believe would be to C.G. Jung's liking. You know, people criticize the Pope and the Catholic Church for a variety of reasons, some valid and perhaps some not so valid. But certainly Jung's criticism, or the criticism of someone who shares Jung's view of reality, will be very different from that of secular people, or even some people within the Catholic Church today who consider themselves progressives. I don't think Jung would have been terribly excited about whether there are male or female priests in the church, as long as there are priests and not just ministers. Because the very name priest, coming from the Latin sacerdos, you know, means worker of the mystery. Not just a preacher, you know, not just an exhorter, but somebody who, like an alchemist, is there and, let's say, possesses certain qualifications for facilitating a mystery. He does not bring about the mystery, that would be a great mistake, but facilitates the mystery. Now, I need to allude very quickly, lest I forget, to Jung's, you know, Jung wrote a lot of material, obviously, but two of his major writings wherein he discusses the Mass or Eucharist. One is a long essay entitled Transformation Symbolism in the Mass, which he gave as two lectures in 1944 at the Eranos Conference of that year in Ascona in Switzerland. And it's also included in his collected writings, but I'll be done in which one it is. It may be either in one of the alchemical ones, or it may be in volume 11, which would be The Psychology of Religion, West and East. But it is definitely included in the Eranos Yearbook, Volume 2, entitled The Mysteries, and these are still being sold. Transformation Symbolism in the Mass. Another one is an essay of his called The Symbolic Life. This is the first essay included in Volume 18 in his collected writings. It was originally given as a lecture at the Guild of Pastoral Psychology in London on April 5, 1939. I'll give you just a little bit of a taste in order for you to get an impression of his attitude toward these matters from his essay, The Symbolic Life. Here is what he said. You see, a man is in need of a symbolic life, badly in need. We only live banal, ordinary, rational, or unreasonable things, which are naturally also within the scope of rationalism, otherwise you could not call them unreasonable. But we have no symbolic life. Where do we live symbolically? Nowhere, except where we participate in the ritual of life. But who among the many are really participating in the ritual of life? Very few. And when you look at the ritual life of the Protestant Church, it is almost nil. Even the Holy Communion has been rationalized. I say that from a Swiss point of view. In the Swiss Zwinglian Church, the Holy Communion is not at all a communion, it is a meal of memory. It is called communion, but it is no communion at all. There is no mass either, there is no confession, there is no ritual, there is no symbolic life. Have you got a corner somewhere in your houses where you perform the rites, as you can see in India? Even the very simple houses there have at least a curtained corner where the members of the household can lead the symbolic life, where they can make their new vows or meditation. We don't have it. We have no such corner. We have our own room, of course, but there is a telephone which can ring us up at any time, and we always must be ready. Yes, and now you might say we also have the one-eyed monster, the computer, and the other one, the somewhat older one-eyed monster, the television set. You know, it's hopeless. How can you lead a symbolic life under those circumstances? We have no time, no place. Where have we got these mysterious images? Nowhere. We have art galleries, yes, where we kill the gods by thousands. We have robbed the churches of their mysterious images, of their magical images, and we put them into art galleries. That is worse than the killing of the 300 children in Bethlehem. It is a blasphemy. Then he goes on from there, and he indicates that the Catholic Church at his time still has a symbolic life. Now then, within that symbolic life, it is probably fairly well known to many that within historic Christendom, the central great act of the symbolic life, the central mystery, has always been the Eucharist. And incidentally, the notion, pretty much espoused by a lot of Protestant preachers over the centuries, that the seven sacraments or mysteries of the Christian Church are a later invention. They are, quote, not biblical. They have nothing to do with Jesus. They have nothing to do with the early period of the Christian religion. Have really been pretty well disproven in our time. Because with the discovery of various documents of nearly biblical age, such as the Gnostic Gospels, for instance, such as the Gospel of Philip particularly, and a number of others, we see that, you know, this goes back to a very early period. The originals probably to the first century, but even the latest copies to the second and to the third century. And there they write quite openly about the seven Christian sacraments. And while they interpret them very mystically, they are nevertheless pretty much the same ones that are still present in such ecclesiastical bodies as the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern and the Orthodox churches. And the central one to these has always been the Eucharist, or Mass, which is a medieval kind of vernacular. The reason that the Eucharist has been called Mass in the West since the Middle Ages or so is because the last words in the Mass, in Latin Mass, are ite missa est. Go, you are dismissed. Go, it is dismissal time. And that was the last thing that people remembered. And so they kept referring to the entire sacramental ritual as missa, which is, of course, very incorrect, because it would mean dismissal. The whole thing is dismissal, you know. But that's how names sometimes come into existence. Now, Eucharist, Eucharistia, is the Greek and means literally thanksgiving. Now, as Jung very correctly pointed out, there are several elements that are present in the Eucharist, and all three of these, several meaning three major ones, have a considerable relationship to alchemy. The first of these is what in Greek is called thesia, and this has, of course, always existed in ancient times, in pagan times already, and certainly in the Jewish temple of Jerusalem, which was the great place of worship. You know, the Old Testament, the ancient Jewish religion, is distinguished by the somewhat curious fact that it had only one temple. You go to India, and there are temples all over the place. You go to Christian countries, and there are churches all over the place. You go to the American South, and there is a church on each street corner, especially since there are much fewer gas stations now. You can have more churches. And you know, there in Mississippi, and I know I traveled around there in the 60s and so, and First Baptist Church, Second Baptist Church, Third Baptist Church, Fourth Baptist Church, Fifth Baptist Church, 25th Baptist Church, all Baptist churches. One wonder, why didn't they build one big one? You know, but no, not even in a town would they build one big one of the same denomination, but this is sort of American individualism. Let's have a lot of little ones. Well, the Jews had just one temple, and that is where God lived according to their beliefs, and that is where the sacrifices were performed. Now, these sacrifices, while they were, of course, somewhat different from the sacrifices of the so-called pagans, still had something in common with them, because for the most part, they were the offering up of something solid to God, who is always envisioned above, you know. Nobody in his right mind ever envisioned God down below. Now, they might have envisioned some other things down below, deep down below. But not really, you know, the divinities are always considered to be supernal. Beginning already with the old shamans, there is the underworld, the world, and the overworld. And in the overworld are the gods. In the underworld are the dead spirits and sometimes demons. And in the regular world, that's where we are. But in any event, the offering up of something to the supernal being, to God, that is, and this is quite crucial, ultimately burned up. It is vaporized. The altar of burnt offering. Now, with animals, the sacrifice also involves, of course, taking their lives, because after all, the Jews were not monsters. They didn't want to burn live animals. But it always involves taking something solid and then changing it so that it will go up, volatilizing it, burning it up. The primary thing in, let's say, the religion of the old Romans, the old Greeks, was what? Of course, they had sacrifices and burnt offerings too. But on a regular basis, something that everybody would do is burn incense. In the front of the statue of a god, there would be a brazier, and you went in there and you put some incense on it, and then the incense rises up to the sky. And even today, go into a Buddhist temple, go into a Hindu temple, and there are the incense sticks that are burning. This has a deep alchemical meaning because it transforms something solid into something airy. It is a changing from element of earth to element of air, to say the least. Going up in smoke, as it were. This is the equivalent of the alchemical sublimatio, the ascent of the soul, or even of the soul of the philosopher's stone, which indeed may be an element of the soul, to heaven. It is a consecrating of the element, changing it from something lowly, we even say lowly down there, low, you know, into something high. Now, I don't want to belabor the situation, but elevating has always been considered as being the grand symbol of the raising of consciousness. As our consciousness raises on high, situation is elevated. The gross, the heavy stuff is left behind. The subtle rises up. Even the rather trite expression arising, say, from the 60s, at least that's when it was probably used more often than anywhere else, of getting high, has a little bit that connotation. Because by way of a non-ordinary or altered state of consciousness, consciousness at least has the feeling. I am not going now into how realistic that feeling is, of getting off the ground, of getting up to a different kind of dimension. So that is the very important part of the sacrifice. And of course, the use of incense has always been present in the sacramental Christian practice, used without fail in the Orthodox Church, but certainly at the most solemn performance of the Roman Catholic Eucharist also. Then in addition to that, it is also a holy meal, what the Greeks called a deipnon, a meal in which the God is present, and it is present in something that is capable of being ingested, and then is ingested. Now, you may recall, or some of you may recall, that in alchemical symbolism, probably more so in Chinese alchemy than in Western alchemy also, the human body and particularly the stomach are regarded as the alchemical laboratory. You know, the alchemical fire burns in your stomach. And it is particularly true when you have indigestion. You know, it feels like fire. But what happens by way of digestion? Digestion is transformation. Digestion is more than that. Digestion is an alchemical process wherein the elements, the constituent parts of the food which are useful to the body are alchemically extricated from the food and then assimilated by the body, and the rest of it, of course, is waste and is then expelled. So here again we have another approach to alchemy. So communion with the sacred element is of that nature wherein we take the sacred into ourselves and assimilate it into ourselves. By assimilating it into ourselves, we become sacred ourselves. When you eat the sacred, you become sacred yourself. Now, I know that especially a sort of rationalist thinking, atheistic thinking like we found in the 19th century and also some in the 20th, looks upon this as something very primitive. But you know, primitive, which is a term not so much used nowadays, primitive does not necessarily mean untrue. Primitive merely means a very simple, maybe for some minds overly simple understanding of a situation. But I assure you that archaic peoples, so-called primitive peoples, know how to think straight. Maybe they often know better how to think straight than we do ourselves. But their thought processes are of a different and less complicated nature than our own. Thirdly, and this is probably in many ways the most important, is that the Eucharist is a mystery. Jung says that the human priest, who is empowered to offer the sacrifice, plays a kind of a strange role in the Eucharist. Because contrary to maybe a popular assumption, even in Catholicism, he does not make the event happen. He does not make the mystery happen. As Jung says, the priest is a ministering agent in the hands of a greater power. And when the priest forgets that and becomes egotistical about it and begins to imagine that he is doing it, instead of the divine doing it, then he ceases really to be a true and effective priest. Jung, in his essay on transformation symbolism in the Mass, uses a metaphor. He says, the hammer knows not the hand that makes it strike. And he likens the priest to a hammer in the hand of a higher power. Now, this is a psychologist speaking, mind you, not a theologian. But you see, the rationalistic mind, the ego, doesn't like that, doesn't like a mystery. It says, first of all, I want to make everything happen. If I don't make it happen, it's not going to happen. That's the attitude of the alienated rationalistic mind. Yet, look, if you are so powerful, you can make everything happen. How come everything is in such a mess? And even to come a little closer to home, which doesn't hurt, how come your life is such a mess if you are the only one who can make things happen? Obviously, you're either not doing it right, that of course is the other side of the coin, or else your view of the whole situation is a little bit wrong. And the not doing it right, of course, is the guilt-inducing side. Because if you are the only one who is responsible and there isn't anything else, then when things don't go right, whose fault is it? It must be yours. Oh, well, you can project it on others, your father, your mother, whoever is around, but ultimately it must be your fault. And then you walk around with what has been called sometimes New Age guilt or modern secularistic guilt, wherein since we imagine ourselves to be sovereign in our lives and everywhere else, therefore, when things go wrong, which I assure you inevitably will at some point, there isn't a human being on the face of this earth in whose life all things always go right. There ain't no such animal. What leads you to believe that you are going to be the first one? And if you were the first one, you probably wouldn't even be that happy. It wouldn't be challenging. It would be, you know, there would be all kinds of things wrong with it. I know more people who have everything they want, practically, and certainly everything they need, who are still unhappy. Well, why is that? Well, because happiness does not really originate in these matters. So a mystery is something different. You have to participate, but you are not the ultimate maker. You are a participant. You are a ministering agent. By way of your responsiveness and your proper participation in the mystery, you are part of the mystery. But the mystery is a mystery. It is beyond the comprehension of your mind. Now, this sort of thing, as Jung pointed out, exists, of course, in allowing for certain differences in all kinds of cultures, in all kinds of religions. I am not particularly fond of human sacrifice and things of that sort, which, of course, is one of the primary sacrifices in a lot of places. But in his essay on the transformation symbolism in the Mass, he goes through some Aztec rituals too, not the bloodiest ones. This is old Aztec ritual that was performed in the olden days and is described by a Spanish priest, the Aztec ritual of Tecalo. Here he says, although the Mass itself is a unique phenomenon in the history of comparative religion, its symbolic content would be profoundly alien to man were it not rooted in the human psyche. But if it is so rooted, then we may expect to find similar patterns of symbolism both in the earlier history of humankind and in the world of pagan thought contemporary with it. So he talks about some things in the Old Testament and so forth. So it is not surprising that we find religious rites which come very close to Christian practices in a field quite untouched by classical culture. Because, you know, you might say that after all there was so much Greco-Roman and Jewish and Egyptian influence in the early Christian church, so obviously the similarities are greater there. But here he says, a field quite untouched by classical culture. I mean the rites of the Aztecs, and in particular that of Teocalo, the god-eating, as recorded by Fray Bernardino de Sahagún, who began his missionary work among the Aztecs in 1529, 8 years after the conquest in Mexico. In this rite, a dough-like paste was made out of the crushed and pounded seeds of the prickly poppy, Argemona Mexicana, and molded into the figure of the god Huitzilopochtli. So this one does not involve the religiously motivated open-heart surgery on the pyramids that we are often told about and so forth, thank God. And upon the next day, here he is quoting the description of this priest who was there, and upon the next day the body of Huitzilopochtli died. And he who slew him was the priest known as Quetzalcoatl, and that with which he slew him was a dart pointed with flint, which he shot into his heart. He died in the presence of Moctezuma and of the keeper of the god, who verily spoke to Huitzilopochtli, who verily appeared before him, who indeed could make him offerings, and the four masters, and so forth. And when he died, thereupon they break up his body of dough. His heart was apportioned to Moctezuma. So you have a little bit of the heart business there, but here in a symbolic form, you know. And as they ate, it was said, the god is eaten. And of those who ate it, it was said, they guard the god, of course, within themselves. And then Jung writes, the idea of a divine body, its sacrifice in the presence of the high priest to whom the god appears and with whom he speaks, the piercing with the spear, the god's death followed by ritual dismemberment, and the eating, communio, of a small piece of his body, are all parallels which cannot be overlooked and which caused much consternation among the worthy Spanish fathers at the time. This has been true of a lot of missionaries when they went to places and found their customs and religious rituals that had certain similarities with their own. They couldn't figure out how these people would have come up with something like this, so they generally assumed that these were customs that were counterfeited by the devil. And he speaks of ancient Mithraism, which was really a rival of Christianity, wherein also a rite of communion, a Eucharist, took place. Now, we need to look at the story a little more closely. Jung said to us, in effect, that Christendom has developed a sacred rite, a mystic ceremony wherein the earthly substances or lower elements of bread and wine are transformed before the believer into the body and the blood of Christ. Now, what is the more esoteric purpose of this? It is that the persons present at such a rite themselves should be transformed spiritually, or at least, let's say, should be stimulated in the direction of their own spiritual transformation, even as the bread and wine are transubstantiated before their eyes symbolically. And once again, what could be more alchemical than the whole notion of transubstantiation, which means that the, obviously not the outer form of the bread and the wine, there is no one in the Catholic and Christian Church, East or West, who will say that the outer form changes. Oh, there may have been some anomalies, some miracles at particular times, that's something else. But rather the substance. What is substance? In Latin, sub means underneath. Stans comes from sto, stare, to stand. So that which stands underneath the outer form, an underlying mystical essence, that is what is transformed. The key concept, of course, in alchemy is transformation. And this is, let's say, a rather eminent example of it. Transformation is, by definition, as we mentioned in other talks on alchemy, a substantial change. A change wherein the substance of something changes. And Jung said that such a transformation is the destined and desired end of the life of the human soul. That's what we are here for. We are not here, according to Jung, according to a lot of really esoteric teaching, we are not here just to be good. We are not here just to become smarter than we are, better than we are, and certainly not just more powerful than we are. For one thing, if we accumulate power without sense, and power without goodness, then we end up being individuals at some level like we had in our 20th century, one with a kind of a funny little mustache and his hair hanging into his face, and the other one with a much larger shaggy mustache, one being known as Adolf Hitler and the other one being known as Josip Vissarionovich Stalin. And you might even throw in a third one who had no mustache at all, Mao Zedong, who was responsible for the butchery of more people than the other two added together, and whose heirs, of course, now supply us with everything, with my socks, with my pants, not with my necktie, this is made in America. So, when you just become powerful without being transformed, heaven help everybody, including perhaps yourself. What is transformed? Here I think Jung helps us, if we don't take it too terribly literally. He says what needs to be transformed is what psychology calls the ego. The ego is the carrier of the consciousness or the lower self. Some of the occultism, coming from the 19th century and so would call it the lower self or the lesser self. We have become an ego, but now we have to transform that ego. We know how it comes into being, that is a matter of development. But now our will, our transformational intensity and intentionality, an intense intentionality has to get into the act, and that is the interior priest. When you develop something within yourself that wants to be transformed and wants to transform, that interior magician. I know Catholic priests get very upset when you say that there is something common between magic and, say, the Eucharist. But there is. When you develop that within yourself, then you have your own internal priest. And the higher self, the true self, what Jung spells with a capital S, the paradigm of the individuated ego, that is the Christ, the transformed self. So the ego is transformed by our transforming intentionality and changes into the higher or transcendental self. Jung says that we must all undergo the stages of transformation, which, like the stages of the Eucharistic elements, are alchemical stages. There are many different names which they can be called. There are correspondences, but in the Eucharist he sees the following: preparation, offering, consecration, communion, and assimilation. Now, let me, in conclusion, in very inadequate way, try to explain these. Preparation. Even as the priest prepares himself and the congregation in the early period of the Mass, so the ego must prepare for the transformation. There are prayers that are often called the collects in the Western Rite, the focusing of the mind on particular intentionalities. Readings, the lesson and the gospel. These are like intellectual preparation by study. If we want to undergo an interior transformation ourselves, we need to learn how to concentrate. We need to learn how to focus our mind. And not for the purpose of making more money, not for the purpose of attracting a new girlfriend or a boyfriend. There's nothing wrong with that, but I think any person worth his or her salt has natural powers to do that. You know. As Eliphas Levi said after he gave you all these love charms in his book Transcendental Magic, he said, but you know, really, a nice man or a nice woman doesn't need all of this stuff. You know, just go out and find somebody. It's for dorks. And they didn't use that term in those days to go through this stuff. You know, there are much nicer ways and better ways of doing that. But it is the ability to focus the mind, the ability to concentrate, to exclude external material, which then brings in the intentionality for transformation. Because what we need to keep in mind, and this is true of alchemy too, I mean, just as I mentioned before, alchemy is not made. The alchemist doesn't make the alchemical process happen. The alchemist facilitates it. The alchemic transformation wants to happen. The intention to transform is right there all the time. Everything wants to transform. Nothing really wants to stay the way it is, including your own soul, or we might say particularly your own soul. I don't know, maybe a rock doesn't mind staying a rock, at least for a while. Eventually it'll get broken up and becomes dust and you know whatnot. It's much more the issue of putting other things out of the way, and that is sort of what the early prayers in the Mass are like. Then there are readings, which are the use of the intellect for sacred purposes. That is why it's important to study good things, to study things that are conducive to the welfare of one's spirit, and not all sorts of other stuff. I don't mean that you shouldn't read a good detective novel from time to time or whatever, because we need distraction, or a book about history or whatever, but on the whole one should definitely study spiritual, really good spiritual literature. Then there is, for instance, in the preparatory period, the creed or the credo. And this, of course, is particularly obnoxious to present-day secular people. What do you mean, I believe, you know? I don't believe in nothing, or which means, of course, that I believe in something, because it's a double negative. So let's say I don't believe in anything. You know, people don't want to believe nowadays, except stupid stuff, which is not going to happen. That they want to believe, you know. But in any event, one needs to clarify from time to time in one's mind, what is my worldview? What is my view of reality? How do I look at the world? What are the basic points of my belief? Now, this doesn't mean that your belief cannot change. I would say that as you gain more life experience, certainly some of your belief will change too. But you should have a certain clarity about what you believe at any given time. Even if you believe something quite different 5 years from now, be clear about what you believe now and be clear about what you believe then. Don't just be fuzzy. Oh, well, maybe this, maybe that, yeah. Maybe the soul survives death, maybe there is reincarnation, maybe there isn't, well. This lack of precision, lack of distinction, fuzzy-mindedness, should not be confused with mysticism. Alan Watts, again, of blessed memory, used to say, mysticism is not derived from mist and fog in your mind. You know, it comes from something else. Clarification. Now comes the next point, offering. The offering of the elements. The priest raises the host, the bread on the plate, on the pattern, and then he raises the chalice of wine with which some water is mixed, which, again, it has an alchemical significance, but it also has, because the water is, you know, very important. The wine is a product of fermentation. That is why these super puritanical Protestants and Mormons and people like that who will use all water for communion, or a bloody grape juice, you know what I mean? In order for grape juice to stay grape juice, you have to put stuff into it that will keep it grape juice. Otherwise, it'll ferment. And so that fermentation is a very important early alchemical process. So that is why it is fermented. So these are offered. Now, what happens within the person? We lift the ego up. We lift our lesser self up and we say, in a sense, here I am. My usual little self. This is pretty much all I know about myself. The rest of it is theory. But I offer it up. I offer it up to the greater. I am prepared for this self of mine to really change. I am prepared to die. This is the symbolism of death, even of the sacrificial death like the Aztecs or things like that. I mean, there is an archetypal symbolism even there. You know, that I am prepared to give up everything that looks to me as my life and the life of my consciousness for the greater, just as long as that greater will come. Jung calls this self-oblation, and oblatio is offering. But, you know, again, how many of us are willing to do this? That's also something we need to reflect on. Really, after all, we don't have much. We may think we do, but we really consciously we don't have much but this ego. Are we willing to? Okay, here it is. I let go of it. It's not that easy. It's difficult to do. So after the offering comes the consecration. This is the central act. The central alchemy. Now the transformation takes place. The central act of alchemy. The greater being, Jung says it's the self with a capital S that the transcendental being within the psyche speaks. It says, this is my body. This is my blood. Now, what does this mean? The body, the blood, whatever you want to call it, my physical body, my emotions, my thinking, they no longer belong to the ego. It's someone else who says, this is mine. This is mine. In fact, it is me. So the higher self has entered into an intimate connection with the lesser. It interpenetrates it. The lesser self has become transparent and translucent to that greater light. When that happens, everything is all right. In my estimation, that is the best thing that can happen to a human being, to arrive at that point of transparency and translucency. And the essential change takes place. Part of that is immediately after, or very soon thereafter, after certain Thanksgiving, is the communion. Namely, the greater self enters the lesser self, and the conjunctio takes place. Communio, conjunctio. We heard of the conjunction of the two, the salt and the sulfur, and so forth, the opposites, the upper and the below. In the communion, they fuse into one. After that, there is the assimilation of the experience. And so you have to come down from that point. And in traditional church practice, in sacramental practice, I think it was very correctly assumed that one should not just finish with the communion and then walk out. But you have come steps up to that high point, then there have to be steps down from it. And those stand for the assimilation of the experience. Assimilation is really to allow the experience of transformation to enter your consciousness. If it doesn't enter your consciousness, then it hasn't done a great deal, because then it doesn't have a chance of becoming conscious. I'm not saying that mysteries that occur at least to a certain extent or initially at the unconscious level are therefore useless. And for something to become conscious is not the same thing as just having a lot of ideas, a lot of thoughts, a lot of concepts all of a sudden. That's a very 19th century notion. If you develop a big complicated verbiage, a big complicated set of explanatory categories about everything. An astral body and a mental body and a causal body and the this and the that. And it's a very 19th century occultism again. If you experience those things, that's one thing. But if you're just developing a lot of words and a lot of terms, you might as well give up. To exchange one set of rather meaningless terms for another set of rather meaningless terms does not indicate that a great deal of progress has been made, because it does not mean understanding. Learning words is not understanding, but somehow having the experiences which maybe some of the words allude to, they point to, you know, that's something else. That is what is really meant. That is really what needs to happen. Now we take the experience of the transformed self. We say ita missa est. We are dismissed from the mystery and we go out into our daily lives, into the world, and that's where the implementation needs to take place. Also, much, much more easily said than done. Much more easily said than done. Because, of course, that assimilation is not perfect and it takes time and so forth, but it occurs. Now, as we need to probably conclude, Jung writes in his lecture, The Symbolic Life, mind you, this was in 1939, the following. And remember again, what he writes about are conditions in 1939. He says, that is the secret of the Catholic Church, that they still, to a certain extent, can live a meaningful life. For instance, if you can watch daily the sacrifice of the Lord, if you can partake in His substance, then you are filled with the Deity and you daily repeat the eternal sacrifice of Christ. To the man who really lives it, it means the whole world. It means more than the whole world, because it makes sense to him. It expresses the desire of the soul. It expresses the actual facts of our unconscious life. Thus, I think we have an interesting approach here. And, lest I be accused of not having really done what I promised to do, and this needs to be understood, and with that I'll conclude, is that this is exactly the same principle as the principle in alchemy. If Jung was right, and I think he and others along these lines were right, that the real purpose of alchemy, ultimately, in the case of those alchemical adepts who understood and didn't just go through the motions, was not exclusively or even primarily the change of physical substances in the alchemical vessel, but the transformation of the alchemist himself. So that as the alchemical process proceeded, that's one thing about the process, it proceeds, you know, proceeded in the vessel, the alchemist himself or herself, because there certainly were lady alchemists too, within their own nature, underwent certain significant transformational changes. And the great work, therefore, which it was always said only very few alchemists really accomplished, the making of the philosopher's stone, the philosopher's stone would come forth, the philosopher's stone out of their own nature would come forth, and they would become the indivisible unity, the new being, the new self themselves. Now, in the same way, when you look at the transformation symbolism of the Christian Eucharist, of the Christian Mass, possibly some other similar rites too, what is really intended is that as this transformation, transubstantiation, change by change goes on, is demonstrated on an altar, something similar, something conforming to that pattern, the process conforming to that pattern should take place within the individual himself. Now, admittedly, not an awful lot of people who go to Mass, whether it's Roman Catholic or Gnostic or Russian Orthodox or Armenian Orthodox or whatever the case may be, come out dramatically transformed beings. I would say that most of them probably come out just the same clods that they were when they went in. But can we say with any degree of certainty even that? You need to remember that the Christian churches, has become a mass movement. It happened to other religions. Buddhism certainly started out as a very esoteric monastic spirituality, but it became a world religion. It's becoming more of a world religion now than ever before. Is that something to hold against Buddhism? I don't think so. Neither is it, I think, to be held against Christianity. But what happens when the crowd becomes big is that only a few of that crowd of alchemists is going to come up with the philosopher's stone, at least at this point. But some of the others may change too. They may change slowly. It may not be that spectacular, but something is taking place. And that is why these mysteries have been so precious to so many people. So, such alchemical mysteries still exist. One wishes that more of those who have inherited these traditions would understand them better and value them better and not allow them to degenerate into things and onto levels where their effectiveness is reduced, but that is up to them. But we perhaps may understand. We perhaps may realize that there are such mysteries and draw from them the necessary conclusions both for our own psyches and for our understanding of life and of the world. And I hope that has been maybe to a little extent accomplished this evening, and I hope to see you next week. Thank you very much.
Copyright NMI by BC Recordings. Catalog number 300104. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's gnosis.org.